Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 11:40 a.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is Friday, November 15th, and of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off the week with the S&P 500. It has been up again in here this week. It is continuing to extend the breakout above the psychological 3,000 level. I think at this stage of the cycle, where there is still a great deal of fear, where people are expressing a great deal of reluctance to accept that we've seen a breakout, that there's the potential now for a significant move on the upside, yet people are worried about a major pullback. The memory of the visceral pullback that we had in November, December of last year is still very fresh in people's memories, and they are obviously reluctant to chase a breakout. I think it is important, however, to pay attention to the consistency of the trend. And I'll talk a little bit in a moment about why I think it is now more important than ever to have an objective way of looking at the market. Because we are increasingly less likely to see sources of negative opinion appear in search engines, basically any market is made up of bulls and bears. There are going to be hyper bulls on one side in a polarized market. There are going to be people who are bullish day in, day out, regardless of what the price does. The Vision Fund is a good example of that. They are talking about 300-year time horizons. So anything that happens over the course of a six-month or one-year period is a rounding error when you are thinking on that kind of time horizon. Then, of course, there is the other side of the equation, where there are going to be people that think that the financial system is a house of cards, that the trajectory of debt and the inability of governments and municipalities to fund either themselves or their pensions is inevitably going to create a massive debt deflationary spiral. So that's the other side of the polarized view. These people are going to be bearish regardless of what happens in terms of prices. What we are in fact seeing, though, is that because of the way that the search engines are now being optimized, and there is a clear political ambition behind it all, whether that is to sway public opinion or whether it is to further a political perspective, what we are certainly seeing is the subvention of search results, so that those people that are on the fringe of the bearish view don't get any kind of real placement when people go looking for it. Now, what that in fact then contributes to is a view that what you see on the internet cannot be believed. That's something that is out there on the horizon, that is already well underway. What it also means is that when it does eventually come to the peak in this market, and where usually then you're going to have somebody who has been a hyper bear all the way through the bull market rises to popularity, well, that will be more difficult because they're simply not going to get the same kind of placement on a search engine. I think that's rather important, because what it also contributes to is we are approaching a mania. Crowds are sharply discriminatory. When you look at what is the driving force behind this bull market, it has been the rise of technology. Technology has been by far and away the best income producer. It has been responsible for the majority of the earnings growth in Wall Street over the course of the last decade, and the largest companies in the world today are all from the technology sector. Arguments about whether that is in fact the the right way to price a market, whether it is justified that these companies should be at the in the position that they're in. That's a natural part of the give and take in markets. But when you start to think about a mania, there is a much more aggressive emotional response. And what it translates into is this divergence. There is, in a mania, there is always going to be the crowd that is with the mania. And as long as you're part of the crowd, you're accepted. If you're not part of the crowd, it isn't so much that you're ignored, but you're vilified. And that's exactly what we're starting to see. And it is showing up in search engine results, but it's also showing up in other parts of the market. Now, what that also suggests is that this is by far and away the most important time to pay particular attention to the stock market and its trend and the consistency of the trend. Because it is at exactly this time when the siren call of the future, of the potential that is out there for the human experience to be improved beyond measure. And the fact that it not only is a tempting, but also it almost seems a realistic potential outcome that we could just reach out and touch. I'm posting a report today from the Vision Fund. What they're talking about is universal happiness. I just can't think that they're still thinking about humans when they start to think about that. The human experience is a mix of emotions, but that's largely beside the point. Then they're talking about computing power being 300 times the computing power of the human brain. I think that that is a logical way of thinking. It's inevitable that we're going to have much more computing power as the years go on. That's obviously just a running forward of the exponential pace of innovation in computing power and the kind of moves that we've had in quantum computing certainly help to suggest that it is potentially possible. Then, of course, there is this additional point that they're predicting radical life extension, that people will live up to 300 years, and that's a more than tripling of where the median age is today. Well, of course, if you are planning on working for 40 years, retiring for 260 years suggests a complete rethinking of the kind of expected returns from pensions. Either that, or we will be working for 240 years of our lives. Perhaps nobody's really thinking about that. But what it is also evidence of is that in a mania, that the way that you can justify eye-watering valuations is to lengthen the maturity of the dividend discount model. You don't just look at cash flows for this year or next year or the year after, but you start looking at cash flows going out to 2025 or 2030. Well, what SoftBank is doing is that they're justifying the eye-watering valuations they've paid for companies like Uber and Lyft with valuations on their expected returns in 2300. And that's rather a long time. Well, what that does suggest is that we are approaching a mania phase, that I've been talking about the potential for a mania to evolve in the stock market for, I think, what feels like a while now. But what we're certainly seeing is that the major tech-heavy stock market indices are now breaking on the upside. And this is the completion of another approximately 18 to 20 month range. It's the third one we've seen in the context of a decade-long bull market on the S&P 500. there have been periods when the market has gone sideways, and those periods of time have coincided with reversions to the 1,000-day moving average. And the 1,000-day moving average tends to be a useful average in really quite significant medium or secular bull markets. It's next to near useless during the 13 to 18 year periods of consolidation that follow the secular bull markets. There are going to be ranging phases and trending phases in any secular advance. And the rhythm of this market is that we get approximately 18 months of ranging and approximately 18 months of trending. Well, the trend has now started again. I think the most important thing that's happened on the chart of the S&P 500 is the massive upside weekly key reversal from the region of the trend mean back in June. Since then, the market has held a sequence of higher reaction lows. There is absolutely no denying that the index at the moment is overextended relative to the trend mean by about 8%. So the higher it goes, the greater the likelihood is that we're going to get at least a pause in a consolidation. But it would have to at least sustain a move below the 200-day moving average to begin to suggest that the trending phase is over, and a sustained move below the 1,000-day moving average to confirm that the secular trend is over. Those are the two, I think, most important characteristics and consistencies of this really incredibly impressive bull market over the last decade. Now, when we think about what it is, where is the truly bubbly activity? Well, I think when we think about the banking sector, we get I think it's a really great example of what happens when you are the epicenter of risk. So the S&P 500 banks collapsed in 2007 and 2008. They have had successive rafts of regulation imposed upon them over the course of the last decade. And yet, after all that time, there has been a massive reordering of the constituents of the index. And now we have it back in the region of the peak from 2007. What we have seen is a massive deleveraging of their balance sheets. They are not capable of taking on the same amount of risk that they had before. They don't have the pool of talent either to, even if they did have the capital, they've closed a lot of the prop trading desks, so they don't have the same people with the same skill sets to even engage in these markets. They are running completely different businesses as a result. Well, on the other hand, well, we have to think about what are the sectors that have done best coming out of the credit crisis. It would be very tempting to say, well, it must be something like semiconductors, which have been leading on the upside during this breakout over the last few weeks. We can also see here that the 1,000-day moving average hasn't been especially useful here either, the pullback we had in 2018 didn't quite represent an overextension. The subsequent rally that we've had is an even wider overextension. This is something that also suggests that we are moving into the mania stage. It is when we get very, very wide and prolonged overextensions relative to the 1,000-day moving average. That is generally when we start to see mania activity taking hold. So certainly the performance that we're seeing in the semiconductors index is incredibly impressive, and there is no real sign yet that it is over, but certainly we have a short-term overbought condition evolving. if we're thinking about where the potential is for an acceleration on the upside, well, it could potentially be here. But I don't think that it's semiconductors is where we've had the real evidence of a mania, but much more in the private equity sector. And when we think, for example, that the move that we had in private equity back in 1988, or excuse me, 1998 and 1999, peaking in 2000, was a very substantial move, but it was exceeded in 2012. And since that move in 2012, the performance of private assets has just about gone up by a factor of four. So that's an incredible performance. And what we've certainly seen is the valuation that's been attached to these private assets has gone through the roof. It is something that is a clear indication of the mania that we're seeing in the private equity sector. Now, we've also seen that the banking sector no longer is the primary source of mortgages. It is also non-bank lenders that are engaged in the provision of mortgages and, in fact, in the auto loan sector as well. So, in many respects, the banking sector has been completely de-risked, and all of the risk that had been sitting in the banking sector has moved into the private sector. Many of the companies that have exposure to these private assets are not listed. That would be a partial salve to investors, except for the fact that a significant number of pension funds have been invested in these private assets, remain invested, and are at acute risk of drawdowns in the event that the intangible valuations that have been attached to these private assets start to contract. When we look at the outlook for some of the companies that have in fact come to market, well, Uber Technologies is perhaps one of the biggest ones, and it has continued to trend downwards. It's not quite half of its IPO value, but when Travis Kalanick took the expiry of the lockup to sell $500 million worth of shares, that's not exactly a vote of confidence in the longer term outlook for the company. The home delivery and food delivery business has been disastrous for Grubhub, and it is down very meaningfully from the peak put in the latter half of 2018. One of the reasons why we've seen Walmart doing better is exactly because it has focused more on the provision of or in delivering food items than it has in other items, and it is taking some of Grubhub's lunch. Of course, that downward dynamic and then subsequent pullback here suggests that we have seen at least a peak of near-term significance for even Walmart, which has been among the best performing shares. Then, of course, I think it's the go-to share during this bull market has been Amazon. And it is still below its trend mean. And it continues to pull back from the most recent test of it. I saw this graphic in here today, and it is further confirmation of what I saw in the customs warehouses down in LA Port back at the beginning of October. The thing that I've been accustomed to seeing over the course of the last 3 years is forklift trucks zooming everywhere, with trucks queuing to pull up to a bay so that they can get loaded. And one has to really watch one's feet because there are seriously there is serious danger of getting rolled over by one of these forklifts. They are zooming around in these warehouses. But that just was not the case in October. In the warehouse that I've gone to the last few times, there are approximately 30 bays, and most of them were empty. There were only two forklifts working. There were at least another four or five more parked up against the wall. There were men standing around. Most of them were older. All the young guys had been let go. And when I talked to them, and I'd never had a chance to talk to them before because they've always been too busy, they said it had been like that since July. And of course, that was when we had the additional tariffs imposed. Well, certainly this contraction in container traffic year over year coming through California is directly impacted by the outlook for China and the exports coming from China. A lot of the goods that get imported from China and end up on Amazon. One thing we've certainly seen is that sales on Mrs. Tracy's business on Amazon were just below where they were in October last year, and they are down again in November. When we think about the share, it is encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. Amazon has been the buy-the-dip share of this bull market. It has been one of the very best performers of any market internationally. The success with which it can continue to hold its recent lows is, I think, going to be a big test of the resilience of the US consumer. So that's certainly something that we need to pay attention to. Then when we think about what's going on with Google, it's pushing, continues to push on the upside. It has resolved this 18-month range with a really quite impressive breakout this week, up another $20 in here today. This has been a very impressive staircase step sequence uptrend. The pullback we saw in 2018 was larger than anything we'd seen over the course of the entire trend. It absolutely needed to hold the $1,000 level. It has done that, and now we're pushing on to new high ground. Google is a company that has got a lot of promising side projects, which whether that is going to be autonomous vehicles, whether it is going to be autonomous or electric powered planes, whether it is going to be its concentration on quantum computing. These are all really very significant pieces of innovation that are not really in the price right now. The biggest risk I think that the company has is antitrust, because there is an increasing attitude that it is acting more as a censor than as a provider of information. And that is, I think, going to be a challenge. One thing I found particularly interesting just before I started recording was to look for the term financial Armageddon. Well, then there is this article from the Wall Street Journal, and it is to the effect that heeding financial Armageddon predictions doesn't work. Then there's another one says, stop freaking out. Then why budget deficits are not a sign of financial Armageddon. So I thought this was interesting. This is, I think, when we look at the top results for the term, what we're getting is, in fact, news about how it's not going to happen. When we look at Bing, which is run by Microsoft, then we get the book and we get these videos. Then it's talking about predictions of disaster to come. We're getting something about gold. We're talking about Mervyn King saying slow growth could unleash a financial Armageddon. We can see clearly that the results are different, that when you take a very polarizing term, then Google is serving a result that is completely different to Microsoft. That's a risk That really does suggest that Google is censoring. I already know for a fact that they are refusing to take advertising from people who are espousing those kinds of extreme views. I don't necessarily agree with those extreme views, but that's rather beside the point. When we think about censorship, censorship is something that has to be pointed out and really has to be worked against, because we are moving increasingly towards an environment globally where there is a lot more control over what can and cannot be said. And that is not conducive to the kind of transparency that leads to a bull market environment where people can have some faith in what it is that they're seeing. That's why I do believe that it is now more important than ever to really pay attention to the consistency of trends. When we see these breakouts and ranges are explosions waiting to happen, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside as long as the range persists. If Google is going to move back into the kind of consistent trend that we'd had previously, then it will probably pause around round numbers. It paused at 400, 600, 800, 1000, 1200, and I think probably again 1300. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say it's probably going to pause around 1400, then 1500. So what that suggests is, as long as that remains the case, we're still in a reasonably consistent trending environment. We can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. One of the most important points, one of the reasons why we're getting this substantial move on the upside, where not just Wall Street is breaking on the upside, but when we then start to look at what's going on in Europe, we've had the market, or the Europe Stoxx 600, the broad measure for stocks in Europe, sustaining a move back above 400. It wasn't quite able to hold that advance back in 2000, and it didn't do it again in 2015, but it's got a lot more support underneath it on this occasion, and there is the potential that we are looking at a substantial break of the breakout from this profoundly long ranging phase in Europe. The FTSE 100 has already broken on the upside and it is consolidating around this 7,000 level. When we look at the Taiwanese market, it's been going sideways for what feels like forever. The peak for the market was all the way back in 1990, and it is now rallying towards that peak following this consolidation above the 10,000 level that persisted for about a year and a half. I think the long consolidation that we've had on the Nikkei in Japan is equally important, that it had encountered resistance in the region of 20,000 on successive occasions, all the way going forward from approximately 1992, and now it is finding support in that area. This looks like a first step above the base. It is suggestive that we are going to see additional upside from here. So these are bullish setups. When we then start to think about what is going on in terms of the global economy, well, Wall Street spent a year and a half going sideways. The Federal Reserve took a substantial quantity of liquidity out of the market, all the way going from approximately the end of 2017, when the size of the balance sheet was still around 4.5 trillion. They took it down to 3.75. In the space of just 2.5 months, they have added back in $300 billion worth of liquidity, almost half of what they took out in the first place. If we're looking for one good reason why the market globally has firmed up for stocks, it's because of this massive capital infusion. eventually, we are going to see a situation where the Federal Reserve is going to start raising interest rates again. That could potentially be a substantial problem for stock markets, but as long as they are continuing to infuse the market with additional sources of liquidity, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Something that everyone was willing to give credence to was that as long as the Federal Reserve was increasing the size of its balance sheet, then stock markets would go higher. That was certainly the case between approximately 2009 and all the way up to approximately 2014, when they were still cutting interest rates, or at least leaving interest rates on hold. Now the fact that they are cutting interest rates, have cut them three times, and are also infusing the market with additional liquidity, then that does suggest we are going to see additional upside. I created this chart, which is the difference between the interest rate on excess reserves and the Fed funds rate. We can see that it popped on the upside, which was one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve had to intervene in the repo market. So we've already seen that occur. But I think it's important to pay attention to the fact that when we look at the back history, then it spent most of its time in negative territory. And what that suggests is we're probably going to have to see additional liquidity put into the market in order to reverse the arbitrage, rather than to see it continue to expand or even come back to zero. What we need to see is for it to come all the way back down into negative territory. It's only that which is going to siphon some of the reserves out of the IOER market, and then that will free them up to become to search for yield within the repo market. When we then think about what's the outlook for Treasury yields, we had a very meaningful contraction in yields from the end of last year down to the lower side of the range, which has persisted now for approximately 7 years already. Now, base formations in bonds can last a long time, and the Federal Reserve is largely inhibited in raising interest rates. So there is the scope here that we are going to see a volatile range persist for the foreseeable future. And I do think that there is potential here that we're going to see this yield go all the way back up to test the 3% level. It has paused over the course of the last couple of days around the 2% level. It has pretty much unwound its overextension relative to the 200-day moving average. If it can sustain a move above 2%, then that's greatly going to increase the potential that we are moving back into a supply-dominated environment. Considering the fact that the U.S. government is running a deficit in the region of $1 trillion and probably more than that, and that some of the pension systems in the states, Chicago in particular, are on the cusp of bankruptcy, then it's really quite unlikely the Federal Reserve is going to be able to raise rates again for the foreseeable future. That does hold out the prospect that the sustainability of the debt is going to come into question, and that does represent a challenge in terms of continued demand for even a safe haven status from government bonds. When we think about the fact that stock markets are breaking on the upside, then that is likely to siphon some capital out of bonds and back into equities. When we look at the total return on the U.S. 10-year Treasury, it is still trending higher. As long as it is still trending higher, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And that suggests that It is unlikely we're going to see a sustained move above 3% in the near term. The massive quantity of debt that has is still sporting negative interest rates, well, that total is contracting. It's down to about 12 trillion, and it was at 17 trillion back in August. So we've certainly also got another way of thinking that the demand for a safe haven is being removed in the short term. And the dollar index continues to steady around the region of the 200-day moving average. It was in negative territory in here and yesterday. We've had the rebound from the trend mean. The big question remains, however, whether it can continue to sustain the 97 area. Germany just about squeaked past without getting a recession in data released this week. The big question then is that going to stay the hand of the ECB in providing additional support? The euro has been trending down in a consistent manner for most of the last few years. It's going to have to sustain a move above 112 in order to really confirm that we're not back in, or think to confirm that there's a change of trend is probably the best way to think about it. But we are potentially now seeing a higher reaction low. So I think the fact that the Federal Reserve has stopped cutting interest rates and that they are continuing to add additional liquidity, that additional liquidity is going to create less demand for dollars, and therefore the potential is that other currencies can do better. The fact that I think the most bullish characteristic for the dollar over the last couple of years has been the fact that they were reducing supply, but they are now increasing supply, and they're increasing supply aggressively. So that should start to weigh on the fortunes for the dollar. And if that's the case, then this consolidation that we've seen in gold is probably just a consolidation. I think the most impressive thing that gold has done over the course of the last 4 months has been to pull back in a very measured fashion, that it has not been pulling back in a violent manner. When we look at this over the longer term, then we can clearly see that there was a lengthy period of ranging which was resolved by a substantial break on the upside, and now we're getting this pullback towards the upper side of that base formation and the region of the trend mean. I continue to think that the synchronicity that we've seen in the market over the course of the last couple of years is very similar to what we saw following the big pop on the upside in 1999 and the subsequent breakout in 2002. That breakout came all the way back down and tested the upper side of the underlying range, and for a brief period even exceeded it. And then it recouped the entire decline again within the next year. And that whole period of ranging represented a first step above the base, which then gave way to this just phenomenal bull market going all the way up to $1,900. So if this is a new bull market, I would hazard that we are still in very early stages of it. I've seen the Dow Gold ratio being used as an argument for why gold should continue to outperform over the long term by a substantial number of the very bearish people, or what might be treated as gold bugs. Well, this chart is 100% up to date. What we've seen is that the Dow Gold ratio is bouncing from the region of the trend mean. I think that there are two somewhat complementary trends and themes that are helping to sustain the gold bull market, but also stock markets. It's the fact that currencies are being devalued left and right. There is, I think, shadow inflation. Housing prices, insurance costs, education, and healthcare are all trending higher. And that is eating into the savings of large parts of the population. It's one of the reasons why we have this uptick in political populism. The response to that has been to continue to pump additional liquidity. That is devaluing the purchasing power of the currency in our pockets, or increasingly on our phones. Well, that is helping to inflate asset prices, whether those are private assets, public assets like stocks, or hard assets like gold and property, then they're all responding to the same kind of theme. If we're moving into a bubbly condition and another substantial break on the upside from stock markets, then there is the scope that stocks are going to continue to outperform gold. The fact that they are bouncing from the region of the trend mean right now is supportive of that view. But there is also the potential that the more that the potential for a currency war increases, then there is the scope that gold is going to continue to rally because of its hedging potential. That means that this ratio will be choppy. We'll get periods when stocks will outperform. We'll also get periods when gold will outperform. I think one of the things that people are very eager to point out are that we've had, during the bear markets for equities, the ratio has come all the way down to approximately 2, and the last time it bottomed was around 6.3, and people are looking for that to come back down to 2. They seem to ignore the other point is to look at the peaks, and each of the peaks has been higher than the last. So we are certainly seeing some mania activity. We're also seeing the potential that the productivity gains from technology are going to be entering the market over the course of the next few years, that the rollout of 5G, the prevalence of cloud computing, the potential for 5G to both enhance the bandwidth of internet communication and to remove latency. That, and by latency, what we can think of that of is as delays. Then the lag effect will disappear. That is going to greatly enhance the scope for remote control driving, flying, surgery. What it also means is that we could have a very clear delineation between where people live and where they do their jobs. That also enhances the scope for robotics to continue to increase. We have the scope for automated manufacturing, automated warehousing. These are all the kinds of things we could see within the next decade. But what we've also seen in here this week was that Adidas has shuttered two of its automated manufacturing centers in the USA and is in fact moving the robots to Asia. They just haven't been able to make it work. That doesn't necessarily mean that the technology is dead, but rather that it might yet still be too immature. One thing we can certainly say is that the share has gone up spectacularly over the course of the last 5 years and is looking like this is at least a mean reversion going on right now. I think these are incredibly important points, that when we think about the secular bull market, that we're getting bubbly activity right now, really quite similar to the kind of activity that we saw, I think, perhaps in 1987 or another way of thinking about it is that this is more like what we saw in 1998, and that it was, or even in 1995, that we then had the massive move on the upside subsequently. Considering that the market has been going sideways for just a few years and is now breaking on the upside, that we're seeing liquidity infusions starting to hit the market again, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. If the Dow Gold ratio is going to remain consistent, then we should see it pushing onto new high ground. If we're looking at the size and scope of this bull market led by technological innovation, which is potentially on the cusp of producing massive productivity gains, then we also have to be prepared for the fact that markets are going to go substantially higher from here. If the Dow Gold ratio follows its pattern, then it should peak sometime in the early 30s, in the early 2030s. And that's a decade from now. So that suggests that there is ample scope for a further iteration of this bull market. That one of the most important things to pay attention to is corporate profits. Not so much if corporate profits are going sideways or if they continue to rise, that would be even better news. But if they start to decline, then that is something we need to pay attention to. The most important, I think the easiest thing right now is, because the consistency that we see on the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ is so easily identifiable on a 10-year basis, that this is an increasingly easy market to monitor. We can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside until we see topping activity. We don't see topping activity right now. There are things to worry about. There are always things to worry about. And I think the biggest thing to worry about remains the slowdown in China. They are refusing to pull the levers of stimulus. They are trying to avoid a Minsky moment. There is the catch-22 that by tolerating weaker growth and a lower credit impulse, that they may in fact lose control of the economy. That is a clear risk. That is, I think, the biggest thing we have to worry about right now. But right now, too, stock markets continue to do better. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.